We'll try to explain the key ideas behind these continuous galactic methods and how do they compare with finite volume methods. And finally, I will present some of the results that we obtained with our one-dimensional code that we use to test these methods in GR. And I will draw the conclusions. So the motivations can be basically summarized by this picture that I took from this paper by Baiotti et al. In 2008. Where they show the convergence for the gravitational waveform extracted by, in the case of a binary neutron star run. And what can be seen from here is that the convergence order is very small. In particular, what they measure is a convergence order which is around 1.8 during the in-spiral and something even smaller after the merge, something like 1.2. And as far as I know, this is the only case in which the convergence order have been shown explicitly. And, of course, this convergence order is not large enough to obtain meaningful information. In particular, if you want to do accurate gravitational wave extraction or if you want to have a quantitative description of what happens after the merge, I think that higher accuracy is needed. And there are basically two ways to obtain a higher accuracy. One is to try and come out with a better way of doing AMR, and another one is to explore the possibility of using higher order methods. And in particular, I try to look at these continuous galactic methods because they're becoming increasingly popular in other areas of computational physics. In particular, these kind of methods are somehow in between spectral and finite volume techniques. So the hope is to get, say, the best of both worlds. In particular, these are conservative and shock capturing schemes like finite volume so that you can resolve discontinuities without any problem. And at the same time, they obtain very high accuracy when the solution is smooth. In particular, you can obtain polynomial order accuracy by reducing the grid step or even a spectral accuracy if you increase the order of the polynomials that you use to represent the solution. And finally, as finite element methods, they are particularly well suited to work on a structure bits and have the very interesting property that they scale very well. And the reason is that they have very compact tensile. And this tensile is independent of the order of the method. So in particular, you can use, for example, a method which is order 5 and still have a tensile which is just 1 point. And this is particularly convenient if you want to do domain decomposition and scale up to hundreds of thousands of cores or so. And finally, these methods have also been considered for the evolution of the vacuum Einstein equations by other groups. So I would like to explain at least the key ideas behind this continuous galactic method. So in order to do that, I will consider a simple one-dimensional scalar conservation law and the discretization with finite volume methods, which is the technique that almost everybody's using. So what you do there is you evolve the average of the solution over each cell by computing the fluxes in a flux-conservative way. In particular, the fluxes here are computed using approximate Riemann solver usually, and these Riemann solver are fed with the data at the boundary of the interface. The only problem with this scheme is that it's first order. So in order to obtain higher order schemes, the usual approach is the so-called muscle approach. So you fed to your Riemann solver a higher order reconstruction of the solution, which is usually obtained by reconstructing the solution from the data in the neighboring points. This has the advantage that you can increase the order, but the main problem is that now your Riemann solver needs to know all the information about your solution, even far away from the interface. And how far away depends on the scheme. So, for example, for PPM is up to 3 points, I think. The difference in these continuous galactic methods is that you don't just evolve the average of the solution, but you evolve also the different moments of the solution, such as the slope and the curvature. And if you do that, then you can just use the value of the solution that you are already evolving to feed your Riemann solvers. This means that you just have to communicate this unique data point from the neighbor in order to compute your fluxes. Apart from the fluxes, you have to also to compute this extra term, which is only a local term, and that involves higher order moments of the solution, of the numerical solution. In the multidimensional case, yes. This part here?
Yeah.
Yes, but this is a partial derivative over the test function. I will explain in a moment why this is not global. Basically, what you do in this continuous Galerkin methods is you solve for your solution, but you have a test function to play with. The test function is completely determined by you. So in particular, what people usually do is they choose a test function that has a compact support inside of your element. So you don't have to worry about the derivative of the test function outside. Or the important point is that the test function is known a priori, so the derivative is trivial. Okay, in the multidimensional case, nothing really changes, apart from the fact that the grid is more complicated. In particular here, I consider a generic conservation law. And I will illustrate briefly the steps necessary in order to obtain a discretization. The first step is usually to generate the numerical grid. In this context, what people usually do is they just consider a reference element, which in this case they took to be a triangle, but which in other contexts can be other things like a square or a cube if you are working in 3D. And then you map this triangle into the physical space by means of a family of mappings. And the important thing in this kind of methods is that the mappings are not just a sort of tool that you use to generate the grid, but are an active part in the numerical method, because what you do at the end is use the mappings to pull back the equations on the reference element, where the geometry is simple and you know everything. And this means that you can discretize easily all the differential operators. This is the main reason why these schemes are so useful when you work with unstructured grids. Next, you construct the weak formulation of the equations. This is analogous of what you do when in finite volume techniques, with finite volume techniques, you work with the conservative formulation. So basically, this is an alternative way to look at your original equations. Instead of thinking of your problem as a functional equation for an unknown function that is valid in every point in your domain, you look at your equations as an infinite set of constraints that your function has to satisfy. And this family of constraints is determined by this Lagrange multiplier phi. Of course, in the continuum case, this family is infinite because it depends on an infinite number, because the solution depends on an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And so what you do in a numerical scheme, you discretize this weak formulation by making an ansatz of the solution. And this is when you actually introduce an approximation in the scheme. So what's usually done is you assume that your solution is polynomial everywhere, and you don't necessarily enforce the solution has to be continuous across the elements. When you do that, a finite set of constraints is sufficient to fully determine the solution. So what you do is you choose an appropriate set of test functions, and you end up with ordinary differential equations involving the coefficients of the expansion of the solution over the polynomial basis. In particular, the equations that you end up solving are of this form, where you have two main terms, one which is completely local and comes from this local integral, which is an integral over the current element on which you are working, and a flux term, which is the term coupling all the equations. The interesting part is that the flux term can be completely determined a priori at the beginning of the time step, as long as you satisfy the CFL condition, because the fluxes have to depend only on the initial data. So that at the end, you end up with a system of equations that are basically decoupled, and you can just evolve them with the method of line, for example. Okay, in the case of generativistic hydrodynamics, there are at least two different approaches. One is to work directly in the space-time. This means that without performing any decomposition in space and time. In this case, what you do is you think of generating a grid that covers the whole space-time, or a grid that you evolve dynamically, for example, a moving grid. And you formulate your weak formulation inside of a four-dimensional element of this grid. If you do that, you end up, again, in a situation in which you have local and global terms and flux terms. And in particular, in the case in which the grid follows a sort of generalized CFL condition, you can pre-compute the flux terms, and you end up with a system of local implicit equations. This may or may not be what you want to do, because it could be interesting in situations where you have stiff sources, for example, in resistive MHD, or in which you have moving grids, because a moving grid is a much simpler object as seen as a space-time object than as a moving grid. But it may be extremely expensive. So an alternative could be and is to perform a usual 3 plus 1 formulation and proceed as in the previous example. If you do that, you end up with a system of ordinary differential equations that you evolve on your grid using the method of lines. Okay. In the case of GR hydro, generativistic hydrodynamics, what happens is that the weak formulation looks like this. So it's basically analogous to the usual weak formulation that you obtain for a standard scalar conservation law. It's just that the notation is a little bit more involved. In particular, you still have local terms and flux terms. And in the case of the stress energy tensor, you also have sources that come from the integration by part and basically represent the effect of the geometry of the space-time. What we did in our work was to implement these equations in 1D, spherical symmetry, and in particular what we do is we expand locally the solution in Legendre polynomials, and if you do that, you obtain a system of equations involved with the coefficients of the expansion of the solution in each element, and in particular, a system of equations that can be seen as being a system of equations for the value of the solution in particular points associated with the polynomials that are the so-called collocation points. And this system of equations are again composed by a local and a flux term. And once you compute the flux term, for example, in our case, we use HLLE as an approximate Riemann solver, you can simply evolve the equations using the method of lines. We also evolve dynamically the space-time, but in our case, the evolution of the space-time is trivial, and we use simply a penalty method. So now I will show just a couple of results in order to illustrate how our code performs in a representative set of cases. So one of the first tests that we tried to do was the spherical shock reflection. In this case, you have you consider a system in which you have gas, cold gas inflowing towards the center of the domain, and a strong shock is formed. A particular property of this problem is that in the relativistic case, you can obtain very high compression ratio. The compression ratio is basically arbitrary. And what we did is, in this case, we consider Lorentz factor 1,000 for the inflowing gas, and we computed our solution using our code and compared with the results obtained with standard finite volume techniques. What we find is that our code behaves more or less like a finite volume method, in which the same number of cells and the same number of elements is employed. And this is what one would expect from the theory. In particular, we get results that compare more or less one-to-one with the ones by Romero et al. In 96. And as we can see, we don't obtain we don't have oscillations in the solution, but we have a small wall heating effect. And this also happens with finite volume techniques. Okay, in this test, instead, we looked at how the code performs when the solution is smooth. In particular, we consider a case which is the case of microspherical accretion, which is simply a case in which you have gas falling into a Schwarzschild black hole in the Kolling approximation. In this case, there is an analytic solution, so we just computed the error. And we did two different kinds of numerical tests. The first one is we fixed the degree of the polynomials, and we increased the order, the number of elements. And from the theory, we know that the method should converge polynomial with a polynomial order. And this is what we observe. For example, if we use four-order polynomials, we get a more or less clear four-order convergence. In the second set of tests, what we did is we fixed the number of elements and we increased the number of polynomials. And in this case, the code behaves like a spectral method. because as we can see from this plot in log linear scale, we have evidences that the code is actually converging spectrally. Okay, this is a test which is much more involved because is a case which is much more similar to production runs. In this case, we have we consider linear small oscillations of a spherical TOV, a neutron star. And what happens in this test is that the star starts to oscillate because mainly of truncation errors due to the errors in the interpolation of the initial data onto the numerical grid. So what you see is, if you look at the central density here, you see that after an initial burst, you have a series of damped oscillations. In particular, if you look at the frequencies, you will see that there are many frequencies that are the frequencies of the fundamental mode of oscillations and the higher overtones. The higher overtones are usually damped first, and at the end, especially with low resolution, you are left with sinusoidal oscillations. So we also looked at the Fourier transform of the data, because by looking at the Fourier transform, we can compare our results with the ones from linear perturbation theory, which we can think of as exact solutions. And what we can see is that already with the lowest resolution, which is around 35 points in the diameter of the star, we're able to match the first fundamental mode and the first five overtones. And as we increase the resolution, we're able to match more and more tones. We also measure the convergence in this case, and it's something which is compatible with a fifth or sixth order convergence, depending also on which particular mode you look at. We also performed other tests in the nonlinear regime, tests involving large oscillations. For example, in this case, we consider the so-called migration of an unstable star towards the stable branch. This is a purely numerical test because it doesn't really have any physical meaning. But basically what happens here is that you have an unstable star, you induce a velocity perturbation, and the star suddenly expands and undergoes a series of violent oscillations. What happens is that in the external layers of the star, you induce shock waves that travel toward the center. And we compare the result that we obtain with our code and the WISCI code, and they're basically one on top of the other, except for the fact that in our code we have high-frequency oscillations at the maximum points. In this case, we believe that these oscillations are mainly due to symmetry. And the reason is that in spherical symmetry, oscillation perturbations tend to focus. And this is something that you cannot see in 3D or even in 2D. We didn't try that. What we tried was using a stronger numerical viscosity, so adding a viscous term on top of the evolution.
Everywhere.
You know. And we see that these spikes, they decrease in amplitude, but we didn't try to lower the order at the center. Even local. Because I would expect the focusing to start also close to the center, not just at the center. Yes, in our case, we don't have reconstruction. So what we did was use higher, stronger filtering. This is like reducing the order of a reconstruction. But you cannot really reduce too much because in our scheme, in spherical symmetry, we have to preserve the curvature. Otherwise, as we are working with pointwise values, we would violate the conservation of mass. This is a particular feature of spherical symmetry and spectral code. Feature. anyway. Okay, the last test that I want to show is the case of gravitational collapse of TOV. Again, we consider an unstable TOV and we added the velocity perturbation on top to induce the collapse. And here I'm showing the Laplace function at the center as a function of the resolution. And as you can see, basically all the three curves are one on top of the other. And the Laplace collapses to zero, and we are able to follow the evolution even afterwards, even though as the equations become just weakly hyperbolic inside of the star when the Laplace is close to zero, the evolution here basically doesn't have any real meaning. Okay, so my conclusion is that these continuous Kallerkin methods can be seen as a sort of hybrid between finite volume and spectral methods. And the hope is to get the best of both worlds. And somehow they fulfill their promise, even though there are still things that need to be addressed. And what, in particular, what we see is that it's true that they are able to handle shock waves, even in the relativistic regimes where shocks can be arbitrarily strong, in the sense that they can have an arbitrarily large compression ratio. And at the same time, we also measure the fact that this scheme can attain very high order of accuracy where the solution is smooth.
Gor, do you want to make a comment?
So just to come back to an issue I was bringing up this morning. So what happened, does the accuracy of DG methods drop when you have shocks and surfaces? Do you go to first order like the finite volume schemes, or can you do better than
that? You should go to first order because otherwise the scheme is unstable. This is well known. So what we do is we use... In this case, we use
some of us don't know things that are well known. Sorry.
I mean, there is. I think there is a theorem that states that you cannot do better than first order if you are if you have a monotone scheme.
Okay, I just didn't know if that applied.
For example, you can obtain a large higher order with pseudo-spectral methods. For example, even at shocks. But then you have to have oscillations. So what happens is that you have a formally high order, but you have strong oscillations. And in the case of generativistic hydro, this usually means that you end up with unphysical values and you cannot longer evolve. But with, for example, the Burger equation, I've seen people doing that. You can formally obtain high order in the sense that in the L2 norm, your solution still converges towards something that looks like the solution. It's actually the interpolation of the solution.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm so impressed by your talk because we once tried to implement the DG in the Newtonian hydrodynamics, but we gave up. It's so anyway, my question is, you know, in the DG scheme, it's not so trivial to define the radius in your, I mean, in your spherical test. Did you perform the 3D test? In the spherical test,
yes.
I see the density as a function of radius, you know?
Density is a function of radius?
Yes. So how did you define radius?
How do we define radius?
Yes, it's in the 3D Kallerkin DG scheme. You perform the simulation, 3D simulation, right?
No, these are all 1D simulations.
It's 1D simulation.
Yes,
but
there are some small differences between 1D and 3D for DG methods.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the main problem is that all the standard flattening techniques that you use to stabilize the method when you have shocks. They preserve the total mass in 3D or in true 1D, not with spherical symmetry. So what you have to do is you have to correct these flattening techniques, and you have to impose the fact that the curvature of the solution has to be preserved. And the reason why you don't see this problem with finite volume techniques is that after you do the reconstruction in 1D, you just trash the data because you just use it for Riemann solvers.
Mm-hmm. So your test is limited to 1D, right? Test is limited to 1D?
My test is limited to 1D.
Okay. And can I ask you, do you have some perspectives to include MHD in the DG scheme?
Well, not in 1D for sure. First,
we have of course. Okay, in the multi-D context, I mean, it's very, you know, challenging to do so by the DG scheme because, so do you have any comments on that?
I'm not aware of the fact that MHD with DG scheme should be more complicated than with finite volumes.
Okay, Christian?
I was wondering, because we had trouble doing the Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse to the same accuracy as Romero, I was wondering whether you've actually run the Oppenheimer-Snyder test, pressureless dust collapse.
The dust collapse? No, we didn't try to do to run the
Okay, we'd be
collapse.
Curious how the DG method performs in that test. But certainly the neutron star collapse test is pretty impressive. In particular, seem to be able to, in the polar slicing radial gauge case, you get the metric component to blow up, metric coefficient to blow
up
at the horizon. And it seems to be able to resolve it to very large values.
Yes, but in our solution of the Einstein's equations, we use also DG methods with interior penalty, and they are able to solve very small-scale features.
What methods do you use?
We also use discontinuous Galerkin for the space-time evolution part, and we use penalization techniques. And if you use them correctly, then they are able to resolve very small features in the metric potentials. And I'm saying this because one of the problems that we had at the beginning was understanding how to do penalization properly. Because if you don't do that, what happens is that you tend to develop a shock in the radial component of the metric, a sort of shock, in the sense that if you look at the radial component of the metric, it's peaked exactly at the surface of the frozen star.
Right.
So the solution there is, the reason why it works there is that when the scheme is discontinuous, so it allows the metric function to actually have a jump there. And then this jump is, how can I say that?
Well, it becomes singular at this point.
Yes, it becomes singular, but the penalization term is a sort of viscosity, if you want. So it's enough to prevent the metric from becoming singular. Because in the equations, what you have is a term which is a sort of Lagrange multiplier that's proportional to the difference between the metric on the one side of the element, the one side the limit from one side, and the one side the limit from the other side of the metric to the boundary of the element. And this is usually where you get the spike. And this penalization acts like a sort of dumping of this quantity.
I just wanted to ask about the efficiency of the code. Is it faster or is it much slower than the standard finite volume? And if it is efficient to be parallelized?
Okay. First of all, faster or slower? Well, the number of floating point operations that you need to perform for each time step is more or less similar to a Wino scheme, say, finite volume Wino scheme. But the main limitation that these schemes have is the CFI constraint if you use explicit time stepping. And in particular, what happens is that if you don't use a balanced scheme, meaning that you have the same order in time and space, you're usually limited by a smaller CFL factor than we find volumes. In particular, in our case, we just use second-order Runge-Kutta, so we are slower than finite volumes. But if you were to use a balance scheme, then the things wouldn't have been so bad. And also, the idea would be in the long run to go for these one-step update schemes, like the ADER scheme by Valsara, because there you don't have any CFL constraint, and they are locally implicit, so they work very well also with these sources. And he also claims that they are faster than explicit schemes. So if these schemes work, then I would say that this continuous correction would have been as fast as finite volumes, or faster. And the main advantage of these schemes is that they scale very well, because you need just information about one point at the boundary. So the scaling and parallelization, in principle, is much easier than with finite volumes. I don't know if...
Sorry. Don't you have to create the grid or the grid? Because now your grid is going to depend on your solution, right?
Well, it depends on how you... on what kind of that adaptive mesh refinement you do. In principle, you can, for example, in our code, as it is a 1D code, we didn't do any kind of adaptive mesh refinement because it's pointless to show a EMR in 1D. So you can use, for example, the same grid that you use today with these schemes, or you can use unstructured grids if you want to. So.
I was thinking in the binary where you want to put more points maybe at the surface or inside the star. In those situations, wouldn't you have to regrid dynamically?
Well, the EMR is fairly independent from the numerical scheme. What really matters, what really changes, is the number of ghost regions that you need between finite volume and discontinuous Galerkin. In particular, well, for binary neutron, I think one of the ideas could be to have moving grids like the ones that Springle has in his code. But for what it concerns the AMR, these schemes work as well as finite volumes because they are just another way of doing high-order finite volumes.
So if you have a set of equations that's only weakly coupled to another set, such as relativistic hydro, where the coupling between the space-time and the hydro is essentially only through the sources, but is it necessary to have the same grids for both?
It's not necessary in the sense that you can do, for example, you could use pure spectra for space-time and then interpolate between the grids. But
I was thinking purely within the DG method.
If you could use different grids between the two.
If you could reduce... You would expect the gridding to be far more complicated for the neutron star, especially during the merger phase, because there it's trying to capture many of the fine features.
Yes.
Whereas the space-time you expect to be much smoother, and so it doesn't need any
Well, in principle,
complexity. Both
things can be done. You can either use the same grid for space-time and matter, or you can separate space-time from matter completely and interpolate between the two different grids. What I don't know is, for example, if you want to use this arbitrary derivative schemes of Balsara, if you can still do that. But if you use explicit Runge-Kutta, then for sure you can.
Thank you.